From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what it will take to get hesitant folks to schedule that vaccine.
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges for the state, and in fact, local health right now, is in the messaging. You know, you can't just say, hey, vaccines are safe and effective. Come on in and get yours.
But what if there was a gift card? Also, getting into the great outdoors, and why for some of us that involves something extra.
Open spaces and the wild spaces, forests, aren't very welcoming for us because of the history of what they've meant.
Also, an allergist answers questions about what is going on with your nose this spring.
Environmental allergens are increasing, especially in the Midwest. That seems to be our path, but we've reached record levels that we've never reached before.
You're not imagining things. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, everything you feared about your seasonal allergies getting worse, those things are in fact true.
We've reached record levels that we've never reached before, which could also be a reason why some people are being sensitized to these pollens when they weren't sensitized before.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, it's getting much easier for people to schedule those COVID vaccine doses in Michigan and to get them pretty close to home. Even so, there's a large body of Michiganders who still have not scheduled their shots. Public health officials and vaccine suppliers are pulling out the stops to encourage you to get scheduled. What would it take to get you vaccinated at this time? If the answer is 5 more years of results, well then. But if you're waiting for that Target gift card, this might actually be your time. Robin Erb is a reporter for Bridge, Michigan, and she has been looking into this very subject of incentives for vaccination. Hey, Robin.
Hello. It's nice to be here again.
Can I just ask, what are some of the weirdest freebies that you've heard of with respect to vaccination offers?
Well, I think, I'm not sure if it's weird, but one of the most interesting to me is a $10 casino cash. The Little River Casino Resort in Manistee is collaborating with their local health officials. They're giving out $10 in free playing cash at their casino when they have a one-day clinic next week.
Come get a potentially addictive incentive to do something that is good for your health overall.
There you go.
Are the incentives that you have seen discussed, are they necessarily apropos of the business or entity that is offering them up?
No, we haven't heard of a lot of the incentives yet. We heard they're starting to come forth. Really, we're just starting this new chapter of distribution. If you think about it, not too long ago, we were writing about, you know, those mass vaccination clinics and long lines and the incredible frustration of waiting lines and wait lists. Well, we're just now getting to the second phase. We've been able to vaccinate, as they say, all the vaccine eager folks, but now it's down to the vaccine hesitant, or as somebody just told me, the vaccine convenient. And those are folks who just haven't had a chance or haven't taken the time to schedule, or they still have questions. So now we're seeing businesses and partners step up with some of these incentives. So there is also a business that's offering $50 gift cards to their employees to get vaccinated. They're not requiring it, but again, it's a incentive.
Vaccine convenient. I want to get back to that phrase. That's really interesting. But
isn't that good?
I did want to also ask, a lot of times when a business offers up something as an incentive, the value to the customer may be less important than the idea of getting something for free. For example, maybe I had no idea I needed a free set of Tupperware, but by God, now I've opened that checking account and I have got it on lockdown. Those Tupperware are mine. Do you think that the incentives work?
I think sometimes they're conversation pieces too. You know, we all knew about Target offering its, gift cards for the flu vaccine. And it was another reason to talk about it. So I'm not sure if, you know, certainly who can't use an extra gift card, but I think part of it is just kind of a little bit of fun or another little reason to talk about why you might go in and get your vaccine.
So what do we know about the supply and demand for COVID-19 vaccines in Michigan right now?
Like I said, you know, just a few weeks ago, we were still writing about these long lines and this confusion, trying to get a vaccine. Just in the last few days, we had noticed that the vaccine distribution was starting to slow down. And I have to tell you, we were talking about this, I and my colleague, Mike Wilkinson, who's just, you know, watches the data every day. And we were talking about the slowdown. I walked into Walgreens to drop something off, and the clerk came over to me and asked if I needed a vaccine. They had extra. And I said, no, I'm good. And she said, well, do you know anybody else who needs a vaccine? And so I came home. I made some calls to my friends and relatives. They've all had their vaccine. But I also know I have neighbors who are not taking the vaccine yet because they do have questions. So it was a very personal experience in understanding that the supply now has met that immediate demand, and now starts this new chapter of outreach.
Have you heard any suggestion that some of our mass vaccination sites like Ford Field in Detroit or DeVos Place in Grand Rapids, that they might be getting so little business that they might be closing up?
You know, I don't know if that's happening right now. And certainly there are some places, for example, Oakland County, they still do have long lines of folks who are waiting. Now, they've been scheduled. I shouldn't say they're waiting. They've been scheduled. But certainly they're still working through their lists. So I think eventually, yes, those mass vaccination sites will close down. I don't know if we're at that point right now on a Thursday.
I definitely want to ask you more about that phrase that you mentioned, people who are looking for, they're the vaccine inconvenient. What are you hearing health officials think through and process as they try to meet the needs of people who have not been vaccinated yet?
You know, when we think about convenient, you might think, well, it's just maybe somebody who hasn't taken the time, but you're right. You know, when you're balancing life and family and social, you know, other obligations, sometimes vaccines just aren't top of mind, even in the middle of a pandemic. On top of that, you also have people who may not have access to transportation. So right now, health officials are looking at taking the vaccines to where we are, whether that's in your primary care doctor's office, whether it's in a local community center, whether, you know, maybe you're a migrant worker, they'll take it to your employer. So, you know, you can get it right there on the job. And I think that those partnerships are going to be really important for health officials now to develop so that they can get to Michiganders where they are. So it is convenient.
What would it take with the state's vaccine infrastructure to see vaccines happening in primary care docs' offices?
Some doctors are already asking for vaccines, and they do have vaccines. So in our story today, we spoke to one doctor who his practice is right next to his wife's practice. So they ordered 100 Moderna doses, and they gave those out to their patients yesterday. Now, one of the challenges is that Johnson & Johnson right now is off the table. And if you remember, that was that one dose vaccine that was easy to give for folks you may not be able to get back for a second dose. For primary care doctors, they also have trouble sometimes with the Pfizer because it requires such a deep freeze. So there are some challenges there. But if primary care doctors want the vaccine, they can now ask their public health departments for a supply.
When we talk about mobile sites, which, as you say, have been discussed with respect to certain professions and also populations like people who don't have transportation or who may be living on the street, do you think we're going to see a time when there are mobile sites that we see regularly in our communities and our neighborhoods?
I do. In fact, I just got off the phone today with the Allegan County Health Department, and they have a new van. They're going to be sending it out to employers who are willing to work with them. They're going to be sending it out to neighborhoods because, again, a lot of it goes back to a lack of transportation for many people.
For sure. What is the state doing to try to plan for getting vaccines to those who might be A, skeptical, or B, hesitant, or C, just have those convenience issues where they can't get to where the vaccines are?
Right. Well, I think one of the biggest challenges for the state, and in fact, local health right now, is in the messaging. You know, you can't just say, hey, vaccines are safe and effective. Come on in and get yours. You know, the messaging is so critical. The messaging for my college-age students is going to be very different, let's say, from, you know, somebody of a different age group and a different income level, or, you know, an urban community versus a rural community. That messaging is critical. And to some extent, you know, you almost could fault the state for not having some of that in place already. But on the other hand, they are working on it.
Robin, maybe this goes without saying, but it seems like a lot of the state's public health plan right now has to do with people making the decision to get vaccinated. What's at stake here when you think about this strategy to try to offer incentives or rationale or anything that will work to get those to get that last percentage of folks vaccinated?
Well, I think I can say it without being dramatic, but we really are talking lives. You know, we've lost so many people already to COVID and deaths that have been linked to COVID. And what we're talking about is getting to that critical herd immunity. Now, we don't know what the magic number is. Right now, the goal is to get 70% of the state's residents, 16 and older, vaccinated. We think that gets us close to herd immunity. But we're only at 31% or 32% today. We're falling very far short of what we need to be.
Was there anything else you ran across in your reporting that caught your attention?
You know, it was interesting. We talked a little bit about the creativity needed for outreach. You know, and I think there's some humor in this, even though we really are talking about, you know, a life-saving vaccine for some people. You know, one of the doctors I mentioned was joking about a bar that had a tent up outside, you know, for, I don't know if it was for the holidays or for the springtime. And he said, well, maybe, you know, maybe they market it as get two shots and get your third for free. Now, of course, he's not serious. You certainly need people sober to decide whether or not they take the vaccine. But it really does go to this idea that we have to be thinking creatively. We have to be throwing those ideas at the wall to see what sticks to make this work.
You know, we laugh, but there were cannabis businesses in some states offering joints for jabs to, you know, if you could show a vaccination card that had been filled out, you would get free product. So maybe
right. Well, and maybe it goes back to what we spoke of at the beginning, which is sometimes it's the humor or the conversation trigger that gets us thinking about these things that are so terribly important.
Robin Erb is a reporter covering COVID at Bridge, Michigan. Robin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again.
Next up, some Earth Day thoughts about who feels invited to enjoy the natural world.
It's about like a relationship to the land. And a lot of folks in Detroit live on very small lots. So you don't just tend to keep the sort of equipment that would make entering nature much easier.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The human need to connect with nature for mental and physical well-being is well documented. You've probably been feeling some of that yourself this past year. But though America's wild spaces are held up as being equal playgrounds for all, access to nature and its beauties and benefits is not as universal as we would like to believe. Many Black and brown people don't feel the open invitation to enjoy the outdoors, spaces that have long been exclusive in the time or cost of enjoying them, or perhaps otherwise just feel unwelcoming to people who've been in urban environments most of their lives. There are groups that are actively working to change that narrative. They were featured in a series of recent stories on the website Planet Detroit, written by Rhonda Smith, who joins me today. Hi, Rhonda. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've also invited Antonio Rafael to join the conversation. He's an activist and environmentalist from Detroit. He's also director of the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program, or DLEAP. That's an initiative of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center. Antonio, it's good to have you.
Greetings.
So I wanted to start by asking you both just to tell us about one of your favorite wild places, maybe a park or trail that you love. I'm not asking you to give up your best kept secret, but if there's something you could share with us, a place that you love to be.
Yeah, I'm sure Antonio will have much wilder places than I would. I'm not a great adventurer that way, but Belle Isle has a lot of hidden nooks and crannies that I like.
Are you a hiker, Rhonda?
Somewhat. I do hike a trail every now and then, but it's not something that I do avidly.
Antonio, how about you?
There's so many good places in this country. It's crazy. I just came back from Big Bend in South Texas and the Rio Grande border, and I spent a week there, and it was just incredibly beautiful. And the desert's a new environment for me, so it's kind of just like high up there for me right now. But I really love Lake Superior.
Yes, wild though it is. Rhonda, may I ask you, what are some of the central things that we know to be true about racial disparities when it comes to access to nature?
Well, some of the things that we know to be true are the differences in money, so the cost, also the access in terms of how far out. If you think of metro parks in Detroit, they're all outside of the city of Detroit. So those are things that we know that are different. And then in terms of knowledge base, that they are accessible to people of color and welcoming. I think those are some of the differences.
Yeah, we should talk more about the ways in which spaces are welcoming or not. But Antonio, I had a question for you on the question of cost. I feel like there's a cost of, you know, transportation, just getting where you're going. But there's also this entire industry built around the outdoors that seems very much geared toward white consumers. Is that something you've observed as well?
Working with a lot of young folks, you're not going to come across a lot of them in Detroit who have muck boots to go into, you know, murky waters. People don't keep a lot of extreme, like, winter warmth gear, generally speaking, having tents that can handle, like, rain, a little bit of rain. Those are all definitely things that are barriers to entry for camping, hiking, the outdoors. A lot of folks don't have canoes and kayaks. It's about, like, a relationship to the land, and a lot of folks in Detroit live on very small lots. So you don't just tend to keep the sort of equipment that would make entering nature much easier.
Rhonda, you've written about the fear and trauma that being in the woods can bring up for Black people. Could you say more about that?
Yes. Several people that I know, and I'm sure Antonio has heard this too, when we see scary movies, we always say, oh, why does it have to be the white people who are falling? And you know, we operate differently when it comes to the woods because of the history of the hangings of people of color, particularly in this country, African Americans. And so those are the types of memories that we have, be it from our ancestors, be it from just cultural memory, you know, and even the things that we're seeing now, which are not necessarily being out in the woods. But even if you're on a road jogging and it's not in a familiar place. And so open spaces and the wild spaces, forests, aren't very welcoming for us because of the history of what they've meant to our people.
Antonio, as you mentioned, you do a lot of work with younger people. You've had a chance to work with a lot of kids through the Detroit Leadership Environmental Education Program. And I just wanted to ask, as you interact with kids who maybe have, you know, a geographic disconnect from natural spaces and wildness, like what kinds of preconceptions might they have about getting out in backcountry when you start talking to them about it?
A big fear of, like, the water is, like, things like Jaws movies that kind of overrepresent the potential danger of these spaces in our mind and the media that we've consumed. Forests, people are afraid of, like, bears or... one of the things that I always tell the young people is human beings are the scariest thing in nature. The United States is... We're on the tail end of a pretty ecocidal history. And the spaces in nature that we do have are often like fragments left over of something much, much greater. So it's always interesting to talk to them because our program really takes a deep look at environmental history and the history of the land and the way that colonization and spatial segregation and racism impact people. So we get young people to think critically about these issues.
What we've been talking about, these are not small issues in Native and Indigenous communities. Antonio, how do you talk to the young people you work with about a sense of mutual ownership and having some respect for the history of land and who's had access to land in the past?
Absolutely. A lot of the curriculum that we look at in the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program connects with the histories and stories of First Nations peoples. As we're discussing Michigan and how Michigan came to be, we have to talk about colonization. It's absolutely necessary. And I think a lot of times the conversation is left there. You know, people will do a land acknowledgement. People will talk about colonization. These are the names of the native people who are here, the Anishinaabe. But moving it beyond actually building genuine, real relationships with those people, I think is kind of the next level. And both in Black to the Land and with the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program, we're trying to forge those relationships between the reservation and in the hood. In our last year, with we were allowed to do field trips pre-corona. And we took a field trip up to a Native American farm called Z.B. Midgewing up in Petoskey after we went and visited one of the last bits of old growth forests left in Michigan in Hartwick Pines. So is this after studying the history of the clear cutting of forests by settlers and discussing white capital accumulation through so much land that was passed to settlers, we go to some of the very last bits of large old-growth forest in Michigan, and then we continued up north to spend time with a Native American community who was celebrating their fall corn harvest. So in that way, students are actually building relationships with Native people. And the Sugar Bush is another project that we do that builds relationships between Native peoples and urban peoples. And when we did the Sugar Bush project, we brought in sugar makers from two or three different reservations to come spend time with us, to teach us, to pass on stories and knowledge, and to pass on skills, like making spoons we made with Anishinaabe people too. So there's all sorts of ways through building on the land, connecting in person, and connecting just over land and outdoor activities, harvesting activities, seasonal harvesting activities, discussing indigenous ecological knowledge with young people. That's a really beautiful way to go beyond acknowledging, doing land acknowledgements.
Antonio, if I can ask, would you mind telling us a little bit about your entree into wild places and, you know, the thing you said about humans being the scariest thing in nature, what your experience of that is?
I definitely trace it, ancestrally. I think I come from a family of farmers, one generation ago. My grandma on my Puerto Rican side, who I was close to growing up, her family had a farm in the hills of Puerto Rico. She was a jíbaro. And my grandfather worked in a sugarcane plantation in Puerto Rico as well. So my grandma always recreated Puerto Rico in her yard with flowers in the summertime. My mom kept flowers. I would spend a lot of time outside growing up. Our family would go on an annual canoe/glamping. I call it glamping, glamorous camping trip. Kind of a real basic camping where there's a camp site, Yellowstone, Yellow Bear. Another thing is my grandma would take us to the metro parks just to hike and walk around because it did remind her of being back home in Puerto Rico. I also spent a lot of time playing sports growing up. My parents were heavily involved in coaching us in athletics activities, and I was the kid who was exploring the flowers and playing with ants and stuff like that while I was supposed to be paying attention to the baseball game. So I've always had a fascination and love of nature and animals and digging in through the garden and collecting roly-polies and looking for frogs when I went downriver to visit family. So yeah, I've always just been driven towards it, but my family has certainly given us a number of avenues into nature, particularly with an annual camping trip.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Antonio Rafael, who's active with the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program. That's part of the National Wildlife Federation Great Lakes Regional Center. And we're also talking with Rhonda Smith, a writer with Planet Detroit. I've talked to people of color whose families didn't really have a history of this stuff, but who were interested in exploring parklands and wild places. And maybe they were able to, you know, sort of figure out where they wanted to go and make their plans and, you know, overcome some of the, you know, some of the cost issues. And then getting there, sometimes having interactions with white people on trails or in those public spaces that were decidedly unwelcome. And I wonder if you talk to the kids about that and the possibility of finding themselves in that situation.
Certainly it's something that I think we all grow up knowing and experiencing, and the idea of alienation and marginalization is something that I think is very particular to extremely segregated communities like Metro Detroit. So I think a lot of students already have quite a bit of experience just growing up in Metro Detroit, particularly if you have any family in the suburbs, what it feels like to be targeted, alienated, marginalized, picked on by cops, these sorts of experiences. It's something we touch on a little bit, like we set norms and kind of rules and ideas as to best behaviors in going out together towards the beginning of the year, and we touch on them as need be throughout the year. But generally speaking, like I'm not entering nature with the young folks with a warning. You know, it's more like a, hey, today we're going to be looking for birds, or this is how we look for mushrooms, and this is the kind of things you're looking for. I don't think, like, generally speaking, at every outing, it makes the most sense to kind of pump them into the negative potential pitfalls. We're often driving them different places, so it's just about making sure everyone's licenses are and license plates are good, making sure people have insurance who are the drivers in our groups. And those are significant barriers to entry. A lot of the suburbs around Detroit are like Ferguson, and they like depend upon poor black and brown folks driving through their communities without car insurance to help pay for their bills. You find a lot of, like, that to me is one of the leading causes of access to nature. There's such a significant amount of people who cannot afford car insurance in Detroit, or who have, you know, some sort of like suspension or hold or problem with their license, or their tags are out of date.
Can you tell us about some of the experiences you have had with young people who are maybe getting their first taste of being outdoors, and things that you saw opening up for them?
Which thing to talk about? I don't even know. I guess we've been participating with Friends of the Rouge on a number of projects over the last couple years, one of which is really beautiful. We started the Sugar Bush Project with urban indigenous communities and Black to the Land and Detroit Outdoors and Friends of the Rouge. We were actually tapping maple trees in Rouge Park and creating maple syrup. And a lot of young folks tend to avoid outdoors in wintertime. In that end of winter period where the snow is melting and it's so mushy on the ground and the snow even looks black and dark from like the soil and things like that in the city, that's when we're out there in the sugar bush, learning how to identify maple trees, tapping trees. And for all of these students, it was absolutely their first time doing this, chopping wood. We learned how to start fires from flint and steel. All this in Rouge Park. And I know for sure this is absolutely the first time any of these young folks have done that. And it was empowering for one young man to participate in chopping up a tree that we were doing inside the forest to get ready for the sugar bush. So that's one beautiful experience. Another one is cross-country skiing. At a lot of the metro parks around Detroit, you can rent cross-country skis. And winter sports are not something that a lot of folks in the city generally participate in, whether that be snowboarding or cross-country skiing or Sometimes ice skating people have a little bit more experience with, but...
And it's not for lack of snow.
Yeah, well, it's lack of snow. I mean, in Detroit, we don't get as nearly as much as they do on the west side of Michigan, but yeah. A lot of their lifetimes, there hasn't been a major snowfall, but still, it's just... We just tend to be inside. I mean, as urban folks, the wintertime is more just we're in our houses. And things in Detroit generally really shut down a lot in the wintertime. There's less activities, less things going on. So engaging them in the wintertime activities has been a real blessing because it's a great way to get outside, to get some exercise. And the students love it and they take to it really well.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Rhonda Smith and Antonio Rafael about people of color in the great outdoors.
One of the biggest, most important aspects of my job is building relationships with the students' families. So I'm always calling parents, you know, seeing how they could get engaged, because that's really the missing piece is you have to change the culture of a family.
Be right back. With Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue my conversation with Antonio Rafael and Rhonda Smith. We're discussing the movement to reconnect Black and brown urban dwellers to the joys and benefits of nature. Rhonda, can you tell me a little bit about why you felt this was an important subject that you wanted to explore?
Oh, yes, definitely. In addition to being a writer, I'm a naturopathic doctor, and when people come to me, I look at the foundations of the health first, and nature being one of them. And so I recognize the healing power of nature and the fact that we as African Americans and other people of color have experienced a lot of trauma here in the country. And going to traditional medical doctors doesn't always provide a fix for that, and nature does. And so the work that Antonio is doing in his various spheres, I thought needed to be highlighted because people need to know that there are places that they can go, safe places that they can go to experience nature and get healing. And the cost would be just for gear. You know, they have gear libraries, a lot of the organizations that Antonio works with. So that cost barrier is eradicated, and even some of them provide transportation. So knowing that those barriers will not be there, and you can still experience nature and receive as somewhat passive healing because you don't have to do much, but just be outdoors and experience the energy from the sun and the soil and the air, definitely were reasons I wanted to be able to highlight these stories.
Rhonda, we know that there are poorer health outcomes for Black Michiganders than white Michiganders. It's a variety of factors, of course, but what connection do you make when you're talking to folks about how being outdoors can improve that equation?
Well, particularly I talk about the negative effects of the foods that we eat that are often available to us, not necessarily those that we want, but those are available, and how they have damaged neural pathways in our minds, but how nature can help heal that. The microbiome of the soil can do that. The strength of the sun helping to create vitamin D in your body that helps to keep your immunity strong. So those types of things, you may not be able to afford a doctor's visit or to be able to fulfill a prescription, but you can change your neural pathways by being out in beautiful nature and seeing things that just actually changes your mind, literally. So those are the types of approaches that I like to take in encouraging people to take advantage of nature.
For sure. Antonio, when you're working with folks through DLEAP, we can provide experiences for young people. You know, we can take them to places and show them and give them a sense of belonging and a sense of communal ownership of them. Do you think that there are things that we can do that you have in mind that make it possible for them to continue that life as a lifelong relationship?
One of the biggest, most important aspects of my job is building relationships with the students' families. So I'm always calling parents, checking in on them, you know, seeing how they could get engaged, encouraging them to get outdoors and participate in events. I'll send them messages of other events that are happening in the local region and area. And I'm always encouraging students to go with family and friends, because that's really the missing piece. Is you have to change the culture of a family. And it's really difficult because people have a lot of stuff going on, whether that be, you know, multiple children or, you know, activities those students are engaged in. A lot of students' parents have multiple jobs. So there's a lot of barriers in terms of getting the free time and free excess money to get families engaged. But we also offer relationships with other organizations and encourage, for instance, this summer I'm building garden beds in a lot of these students' backyards and encouraging their families to join this program called Keep Growing Detroit, where they'll be growing their own vegetables. At the end of the year, we have an event where the families will be outside in Belle Isle all kind of barbecuing together. I encourage the families to join Black to the Land, which is another organization that I'm a part of that Rhonda wrote about, which is primarily a lot of, you know, single mothers and families and young folks who are interested in encouraging more people to go outdoors. And Black to the Land also is the one who has a gear library in partnership with Detroit Outdoors. And so encouraging the families to connect, because of our contractual MOU relationship with Detroit Public School Systems, I can only, you know, have so much access to the students, and that relationship has some restrictions on that. But if I could get the families to join some of these other outside organizations, you know, I can continue to engage them as well.
Rhonda, do you see Black to the Land trying to make a link for folks between the outdoors that we see in front of us, like right outside our window, and the wider range of spaces that may be available at a little greater distance?
Oh, yes, for sure. They're doing that right now. And that's why they came together and formed a group, all of these environmental enthusiasts, nature enthusiasts, and got together to form a 501c3 to do it right, to be able to help people to transcend, you know, what they see, what they've heard, the narratives that have been around them. So definitely, yes, they are doing it, and I see them doing it for a very long time.
Antonio Rafael is an environmentalist who works with the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program. We've also been speaking with Rhonda Smith. Her stories appear on Planet Detroit about people of color and their interactions with Michigan's wild places. Rhonda, Antonio, it's been great talking with you. I hope you get a lot more time outside this year.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Take care. Miigwech.
I know there was snow on the ground this week, but if you could just ignore what's happening outside your window and focus on the calendar for a moment, spring has officially sprung in Michigan. For some of us, we know that not from the calendar, but from our itchy eyes and runny noses. Whether you're experiencing allergy symptoms for the first time, or you feel like your normal allergies are coming back with a vengeance, you may be wondering, why? Dr. Kathleen Doss is an allergist, immunologist, and medical director with the Michigan Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center in Oak Park. She's joining us today to tell more about why seasonal issues are rearing their heads so hard this year. Dr. Doss, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So this week, I woke up to all the snow and a banging head. First of all, how do we know if we're having allergies or sinus problems or both?
That's a great question. So with allergies, you'll typically see like itchy or red, watery eyes, runny nose. With sinus issues, you may have stuffy nose, which can also be seen with allergies. With sinus disease, though, you may also have more of a sinus pressure or headache or even loss of smell, which doesn't always necessarily mean COVID-19. But they often go hand in hand and sometimes they're separate. If you have a fever, it's probably more likely to be a sinus infection than it is seasonal allergies, though.
Of course, many folks have never had any allergy symptoms before. If you do find in the course of a season that you're suddenly sneezing every 5 minutes, is it possible for a person to become allergic to pollen?
Yes, it can happen at any age. We have allergies that peak throughout our lives. So there are different decades where you may be more prone than others, but it's very common. And right now, what we're seeing is that environmental allergens are increasing, especially in the Midwest and the state of Texas randomly. That seems to be our path, but we've reached record levels that we've never reached before, which could also be a reason why some people are being sensitized to these pollens when they weren't sensitized before.
Texas? What's that about?
I'm not sure why specifically the state of Texas, though they do have a really high amount of cedar trees, and it's so severe when the cedar is pollinating that it's called cedar fever, and it's something that all allergists know about regardless of where they live in the country. But the Midwest is especially being hit hard, and part of it really seems to be that we're having these increased temperatures, increased carbon dioxide. So pollen is starting earlier than usual, and it's lasting a lot longer. So it's typically starting 20 to 30 days prior to when the season usually starts, and it's lasting anywhere from 8 to 20 days after the season usually ends. So then we're having overlapping pollens that normally wouldn't be there when the other pollen is already starting.
Is there consensus among allergists about whether climate change definitely has something to do with this?
That seems to be the suspicion, especially just with, as I said, the rising temperatures. There's been a noted increase in humidity and increased in carbon dioxide that seems to be affecting the way different plants are pollinating. So that really does seem to be leading to an increase in symptoms.
Are there ways in which the pandemic is interacting with allergies this year? What I mean by that is we're spending a lot more time indoors than outdoors, generally speaking. Maybe there are overlapping symptoms, do you think, for indoor and outdoor allergies? What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. And that is also contributing a large amount. So we've spent so much more time indoors, and dust mite and pet allergens and cockroaches are actually things that are more prevalent indoors. So normally we get a break. We'll travel from one building to another, or we'll take a walk. But because we've been indoors for such a significant amount of time, we've had a lot more dust mite exposure than we're normally used to. If you have a pet allergy and you have that pet, you're not having respite and decreasing that exposure, say, by going to work. And with cockroach droppings, those can be anywhere. But again, if they're in your home and you're not able to get them cleaned because you can't really be allowing people into your home, it's just creating a recipe for disaster where we have these record levels of outdoor pollens outside and mold, and then indoor you're having increased dust mite or pet exposure.
You know, I sometimes wonder if what we experience is less an increased sensitivity to allergens, but more awareness and treatment of allergens. But hearing you talk like this, I think it's definitely the kind of year when it's more about the allergens than the treatment.
I think it's a little of both, truthfully, because our allergies negatively affect our quality of life. So if you're uncomfortable and you're sneezing or you're carrying around Kleenex, it's already not fun. If you add to the fact that with the pandemic, if you sneeze in public, everyone stops and looks at you, or if you cough in public, people start worrying that you're exposing them to COVID. And also, allergy cells have a circadian rhythm that's opposite ours. So they tend to be more active in the evening when we're trying to sleep. So if you're having really active allergy symptoms and it's triggering your asthma or your eczema or other allergic skin conditions, you also now have a disrupted sleep. So some of it is awareness, but some of it is it really does negatively affect your quality of life if left untreated.
What kinds of things do you recommend to your patients to mitigate symptoms, is, you know, the go-to still just a lot of Zyrtec, or is there anything else that you recommend?
There's a lot of things that you can do at home that aren't even medication-wise, or things you can do for yourself. So one thing is, if you're someone who likes to exercise outdoors, really trying to avoid peak allergen hours, and that changes from season to season. But right now, say with trees, they like to pollinate early morning or early evening. So if you're able to, taking your walk in the afternoon would be helpful. Showering before you go into your bedroom will be helpful, or specifically into your bed. If you have carpeting, making sure that you're vacuuming at least once a week will help get rid of the dust mites. Or if you have pillows or mattress, getting dust mite covers can also help with the dust exposure. If you are allergic to your pet, you can do things like try to train your pet to stay outside the bedroom and not allowing them on your bed, so that that is an environmental allergen-free zone. But there are other things that are out there that didn't exist even 20 years ago. So if you have comorbid eczema, or hives or swelling episodes, or asthma. So we have these specific biologic therapies which don't suppress your immune system. And while they're not on label approved for allergies, by improving your other allergic diseases, your seasonal allergies do tend to improve. So it's not always necessarily just take the Zyrtec, which will only, by the way, treat for today, no preventative effects for tomorrow. But there are, even if you have a busy schedule and shots are not an option, some of these things can be done at home in terms of the biologic therapy. But there is also treatment approved by the FDA that you can do at home, where it's an under-the-tongue tablet approved for grass and ragweed and dust. So there are so many more treatment options that we have, so you don't have to live in misery.
It sounds like it can be a full-time job staying on top of this stuff.
Sometimes it can be, but as you get better, you can take things off. So I always tell my patients that my goal for them is that they won't need my help for years and years and years. The goal is always to get patients to feel as well as they can with the least amount of medication, because a lot of, again, these allergic patients are also dealing with other comorbid conditions like asthma, which is an additional inhaler or tablet, or eczema, where you're balancing your skincare and various creams. So the goal is really to try to streamline based on what you're allergic to, which an allergist can help you identify, and then streamline that treatment. And as you improve, you can take things off. And it really is a good day when you wake up and your nose isn't congested, or you don't have headaches, or you're not trying to scratch your skin off.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, in this week of the unofficial American Cannabis Holiday 420, about an article that you posted this week about allergies to cannabis.
Yes.
How heartbreaking. Can a person be allergic to weed?
They can be allergic to weed. I've actually had a couple of patients who've come to see me about this. So it can present very similarly to seasonal allergies. So, or if you have a food allergy where you have the exposure, so you have exposure to the cannabis, and then you develop a stuffy nose or runny nose, itchy eyes, itching of your skin, or trouble breathing. So it is possible, and unfortunately, strict avoidance really is the best way if you're developing those symptoms. It's been reported to develop anaphylaxis. So anaphylaxis is when you can have a life-threatening condition. And like a food allergy, you don't know if one time it will actually be the time where it can kill you. So no one should have to die because of a cannabis allergy.
Oh, the humanity. Well, thank you for the warning. And thank you for telling us a little bit more about what all the sniffling's about. Dr. Kathleen Doss is an allergist and medical director of Michigan Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center. It's in Oak Park. Kathleen, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you. It was very nice talking to you, too. I hope you have a good rest of the day.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time.